Committee on Human Services, Health and Human Services. We are scheduled for an informational meeting this morning from the Department of Mental Health. Before we call the mental health officials, is there any announcements we need to deal with, Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. There might be, but it's not. It's escaping me right at the moment. Good morning, members.
I like
morning,
that, Sandy.
Know that problem.
Options open. Just in case.
You're so much younger than I am. You're not supposed to have the luxury of those escaping moments.
Mr. Chair, of all the things I miss the most, it's my memory.
Okay. With that, then, call Bob Nickel, I guess, and Gina Furman to stand, please.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the state administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is in Health Services in the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Gina Furman, the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to spend a little time providing an overview of the mental health system. My plan is to go through some PowerPoint slides and to make it a little easier to follow along. And then after that, Ms. Furman will, I should say Dr. Furman, will add some commentary, and we'll be happy to answer questions anytime, so feel free to interrupt as we go through. I'm going to try to push the buttons at the right time here, so bear with me if I get a little bit behind or ahead of myself. One of the things that I always like to start off in trying to describe the mental health system in Oregon is to do some historical overview. One of the points that I think is important to remember is that mental health is really not a sideshow in terms of the history of Oregon. At the organization of the territorial government in 1843, one of the issues that was dealt with was there were five mentally ill people that the communities in Oregon didn't know what to do with. And the very first appropriation for mental health actually took place during that time, and I'm already creating a problem for myself there. So there was a $500 appropriation made to take care of these people. At that organizational meeting of the territorial government, there were the initial arrangements made for how to take care of people. So there were probate courts that were directed to determine how to dispose of people for whom the families were not able to care. Furthermore, a system was set up in which a jury of 12, and this is a quote, intelligent and impartial men were set up to investigate whether a person was insane, and that was the term that was used at the time. I doubt that half of our voting public right now would permit a jury of 12 intelligent, impartial men to make all of these decisions. It was also obviously a very would be a very costly, at least time costly approach to do that. We serve about 120,000 people, give or take 10,000 either side, depending on what's happening with funding, every biennium in this state. Now, not nearly all of those 120,000 Oregonians, many of whom are children, require the kind of custodial care that was envisioned in the 1840s and later. But you can imagine if we had 12 impartial men to decide the fate of about 9,000 people who come to our attention every year through the civil commitment process, that would be an overwhelming number of people that we would have just dealing with civil commitment procedures. But at any rate, if a person was found by the jury to be insane, a trio of guardians was then appointed. So there would be three, and I assume men, again, although I would have to go back and double-check that, who would be responsible for looking after and making decisions for the mentally ill person. The county at that point was responsible for paying the cost of care. Thus begins the tensions between the state and the county around mental health. The question has always been who's responsible and furthermore who pays. In 1855, still during the territorial period, the counties appealed for additional funds. And they were granted, but in 1856, territorial government took the money back. Again, one of the things that I've learned in looking at the history of Oregon mental health is nothing is new.
Don't change, right?
But it does mark the beginning of the county role in providing and organizing mental health services. So again, while we may think of community mental health as a recent addition, and in some ways it is, the state hospitals were really the mental health system for the state up until certainly the 1950s. The counties have been there from the beginning in terms of payment responsibilities and some oversight responsibilities.
Bob, can I stop for just a moment and let everybody know that we have a group here this morning from Santiam Christian High School, senior government studies group in the back. So I want to welcome you this morning. Thanks for being here. Very interesting presentation that you're about to hear, at least I think so. If you have any questions, you know, I'm sure that you can let us know and we can get you some answers. So thanks for being here today, and I hope you have a good day. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if Bob or Gina had the list of the current, so that we can kind of, as we work through from the 1840s, that we work through to today, the list of shared responsibilities in mental health and social services that we have with our local counties today. Do you have that list with you by any chance?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, I don't have a written copy with me, but off the top of my head, I can certainly.
Gina Furman. I have that list in my office, so I can call up to my office and have some photocopies brought down, if you'd like.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Why don't I just slip out in the hall and see if I can pick one up myself?
Very well.
I think it'll be important for us to gain a better perspective of Bob's presentation.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, one of the things that happened fairly early on was that it was apparent that there was going to need to be some kind of a hospital. It was called an asylum for the insane, if I remember correctly. There was a doctor who had come up here from the Gold Rush days in California. His name is Dr. John Hawthorne. And J.C. Hawthorne was really the father of mental health as we think of it in Oregon today. Dr. Hawthorne agreed to open an institution, and he started in 1862, and it was up in Portland. Hawthorne Avenue is named after Dr. Hawthorne, and the facility was originally on the west side of the river, but it moved fairly early over to the east side. It was around 10th, 12th, and Hawthorne. And at that time, that was a country atmosphere. It was, you know, the philosophy in those days was that one way to help people with mental illness is get them out in the country, get them fresh air to breathe, you know, treat them with kindness and get them out of the situation that they've been in. So that was really the concept. And he ran, I think by all accounts, well, by most accounts, a very good institution. And he started with 12 patients in 1862. And again, nothing is new. In 1863, the population swelled to 28. 1866, it was 77. 1870, 111. 1874, 194. And one of the more astounding facts in Oregon history that it was that in 1877, taking care of mentally ill people took up 52% of the state budget. And we'd be happy to settle this year for, you know, 10-15%. We're not going to get that. So, again, one of the other things that happened with Dr. Hawthorne, this isn't in my notes, but I thought it would be of interest, is that there were questions about whether the care that he was providing was cost-effective. So we think that Senate Bill 267 raised new questions about that, and that's not the case at all. There was an investigation that took place. The conclusion of that investigation was that, in fact, he was providing a very good service for a very reasonable cost. So he continued to operate the facility. In 1880, 2003, we did open Oregon State Hospital here in Salem. And as many of you know, we are still dealing with the buildings. There are patients who are in part of the wing that was built around that time. Much of the hospital, as you also are aware, is not usable anymore, and we do not keep patients in some of the places that are truly so dilapidated you would not want to put anybody there under any circumstances. But the history of the state hospital here in Oregon dates to the state-operated facility to 1883. Just to bring you up real quickly to what things look like in Oregon in 2002, and this is I have somewhat more current information, but not in a slideshow format. But if you look at the total funds that come through my office and those and add in the funds that are part of the Oregon Health Plan, which are Medicaid managed mental health dollars, which are operated by largely almost exclusively by the counties, if you total all of those monies, we have a state hospital budget that takes about 25% of the total funds, and the community system takes up about 75%. Gina, you might want to comment on, because we've talked about that 75%, what does it really represent? You might want to comment.
Sure. Chair Dalto, committee members, for the record again, I'm Gina Furman, director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The 75% that goes to the community budget does not go to counties. It goes to the local mental health authority, which of course are counties. But then about 1% of that is kept for administration. And most of that money goes out into community hospitals, private nonprofits, residential care, things like that to help take care of mentally ill. Only about a third of that stays within the counties to contract out either within the county or with a private nonprofit to do outpatient care for adults and children. And I'm not talking about the OHP Medicare side. I'm talking about just the general fund of the state. So all in all, what the counties, the local mental health authorities, try to do is to determine what is the best service for the person with a mental illness and get that into the proper setting. As you know, we don't have a lot of, we have some acute care beds. We've made great strides in this past biennium. I think we've gotten about 278 more acute care beds in the communities. But that is what we're going to be talking about as far as the gaps, as Mr. Nickel and I try to weave for you what the system looks like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I should say that the 275 was the goal that we had for extended care placements. I don't know if we're going to get quite all the way there, but the point is we've created a record number of additional community placements for people leaving the state hospital, and we'll get into that, I'm sure, a little bit later. But just to continue on, this slide also shows in a graph format where adults with mental illnesses that we serve are actually living. So I'm sorry it's not real clear, but the very tall bar there says a little over 67,000 adults lived with either their family or in some other independent community setting. Only about 2,400 plus people were served in hospitals or supervised care, and this includes all of the residential programs that we have. We estimated that about a little over 2,000 people with mental illnesses were in the prison system at that time. It's grown a little bit since then. And we estimated, based on some housing surveys that we did, and these are always difficult to nail down precisely, but it looked to us in 2002 that there were about 2,500 people with mental illnesses in this state who were homeless. We'll talk as we go along, I'm sure, about the need for housing. I think that's one of the critical issues that may be easy to overlook. When you think about mental health, you probably tend to think about counseling services, but mental health done properly in any state system has to take into account the poverty and the housing and the vocational and the legal needs and all of the other things that go along with people who are quite vulnerable and frankly usually not very well off. So
Sure.
Just
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In terms of the homeless, is that people living under a bridge, or are those people that are in missions and other agencies as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's a combination of all of those kinds of arrangements. Some people are truly on the streets. I mean, I know when I worked in the Marion County system, we literally found people who were in the blackberry bushes down along the river. And we do have some federal funds that help with that in several communities to do outreach and find those people and get them some housing, first transitional housing, and hopefully get them into permanent housing. Other people are bouncing back and forth between the streets, families, friends, temporary housing, jails. So there's a variety of things that go into this figure of 2,500 homeless. But many of these people are struggling literally on the streets and, you know, in areas of the, even in rural areas.
Bob, could you go through that list again of the additional community level mental health supports, housing, vocational needs, legal needs? Is that pretty much the universe?
Mr. Chair, I think that probably covers them. I would probably be able to, I mean, I think there are educational needs that people have, and when you think about kids, which we also need to think about, probably about 40% of the people we serve each year are people age 18 and under. We need to be thinking about how we can help them be successful in school settings as well as, you know, in the adult arena, how we help people get back into job situations. I might add, just because we're on this, just briefly, I think over the years we have underestimated the ability of people with even major mental illnesses to work in competitive situations. And while maybe not all of them are going to be able to work in full-time competitive positions, or maybe not at the level they had hoped to be able to work at some point earlier in their life before the mental illness hit, we think now that if we provided proper supports and the proper approach to employment services, 40 to 50% of people with major mental illnesses, I'm talking about people with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, could actually work in at least half-time competitive employment. I'm not talking about sheltered employment. That's kind of old school. I think we can do better than that. But we do need to have the proper kinds of workforce development and some additional funding, frankly, if we were to achieve that kind of 40 to 50% employment rate. There's one state in the country, Vermont, that has an employment rate of about 30%, but they've been doing these kind of things for 20 years or longer.
Representative Greenlake.
Bob, you don't mention the need to have adequate treatment as well. And you talk about wraparound services, which are critical, but that bipolar that's not able to get the medication they need, that's not able to get the services they need, the schizophrenic that's not able to get ongoing services, is not going to be able to do that with all the...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, yeah, I should add, you know, make sure I emphasize that people do need some degree of mental health counseling, as you might think of it, certainly medications. And I forgot to mention in the list earlier, Mr. Chair, the health care, access to basic health care, because people who have major mental illnesses often have accompanying physical health problems. And I would be remiss in not also commenting on the need for alcohol and drug treatment. Probably 50% or more of people with major mental illnesses, I'm talking about adults, here have some degree of alcohol and drug problem, not always classic addiction, but some alcohol and drug usage that is interfering with them, their being able to lead full and productive lives.
Representative Butler.
Two questions. Did I catch the number? 70% A and B afflicted in somehow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the data around the country indicates that about 50% of people with major mental illnesses have an alcohol and drug problem. If you look at subpopulations, you'll find, for example, that homeless people with mental illnesses are about 90%, 80 to 90% likely to have an alcohol and drug problem. So it's rare in some subpopulations not to see the what we call the dual diagnosis, or a person with co-occurring disorders. In the psychiatric inpatient admissions, we're seeing about 70% of the people who come in for psychiatric inpatient services have an alcohol and drug problem.
And my follow-up question was, relative to the 90% of the folks that are represented here, you say that they're with family or other community setting. Can you help me with family? I mean, 90%, when I'm talking about 3% each for the other groups, is a pretty good-sized chunk. Can you maybe help me to tell me how many are with family and how many are in other community settings and what those are, or is that the balance of your presentation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't have the exact breakdown. I can go back and get that because we do collect pretty good data on the breakdown of whether people live with their family, whether they live independently in their own apartment. Those are the major categories, and my guess is just off the top of my head, it's probably 30 or 40% live with families in this category, and the other 60 to 70% live independently in their own apartment with or with a friend or some kind of independent, non-supervised setting.
And those that were in an independent, non-supervised setting might have the traditional jobs you were talking about, in part.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
Before I leave this slide, I just want to comment that the conclusion of the Governor's Mental Health Task Force and everybody who's working in this field, frankly, is that there are too many mentally ill people who are ending up in our jails and our prison systems. And we'll be talking about that, I'm sure, throughout this legislative session, but that's certainly a key issue that was identified in the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. And I should probably also just add, while I'm mentioning the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, I'll talk about that a little bit more, but Representative Tomei was one of the members of that task force, and I think we did a good job of creating a consensus about what the systemic problems are, and I want to go through those after a little bit.
Mr. Chair.
President Boone.
Just a quick question about why those people are in prisons and in jails. Is it because there's no community treatment, or not enough, or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I think it's a combination of things again. I think that for many years in Oregon, as well as in most other states, we were serving probably less than half of the people who had major mental illnesses. And when you do that for a decade or longer, you're going to create a population of people who have not been treated at all or not adequately treated. They may have come in for a little bit of crisis service. They might have gotten involuntarily committed and hospitalized briefly. But if they're back out on the streets and still not getting access to treatment, that makes it a very, very difficult. I mean, you simply don't recover automatically from things like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. You can recover, and some people do it more or less with or without treatment, with or without medications. But, on average, people who are left untreated are going to have their problems kind of fester out there, if you will. You mix into that the wide availability of alcohol and drugs, and over the last 10 years, the complications that are created by methamphetamine in this state and other states, you really have a fairly potent brew. You also have issues of difficulty with affordable and safe housing, and sometimes people commit minor crimes partly because they need a roof over their heads, and whether it's a conscious decision on their part to say, I'm going to break this window because I want to go to jail so I get a roof over my head, it may not be that conscious, but in fact those kind of things do happen, and I think they help explain this. We do know that if we provide the proper kind of outreach, treatment, caring supports, housing, alcohol and drug treatment, we can dramatically reduce the use of hospitals and jails. And there are excellent studies that have been done. There's one that I know we talked about in the Senate Health Policy Committee meeting earlier this week, in which California did a very solid study of the kind of effects that when you do adequate treatment for people, you reduce hospital time, you reduce homelessness, you reduce days spent in jail, you increase the days people spend in competitive employment. And we'd be happy to get that kind of study for the committee if you'd like to look at that one. But that's a kind of a long answer, but I think that summarizes mm-hmm. the issues.
Yeah, I'd like to see that study. Okay.
Well, I'm going to rapidly try to move us through some other history. Community mental health centers, that's what CMHC stands for. I'm sorry for the acronym there. Really, as they started developing in the 60s through the federal acts that were passed in Washington, D.C., there was a lot of hope that community mental health programs would solve the problem of people being in institutions. Simultaneously, or actually a little bit before this, we began releasing large numbers of people from state institutions all over the country. And the real wave, the large wave of deinstitutionalization, did not happen in the 1980s or 90s or now. It happened in the late 1950s, where we went from a state hospital population of 5,000 people with a population base obviously much smaller, to today we have about 1,500 people in a year who go through the state hospital system. But that dramatic reduction in hospitalization really took place in the late 50s, early 60s. So the hope was that the community mental health programs that were going to be federally funded and really never materialized fully as envisioned, there was the hope that they would take care of the people who were leaving state hospitals.
Bob, can I ask a question?
Representative Toomey.
Isn't that a lot of the reasons they were discharged from hospitals? Was there new medications available that would alleviate some of their symptoms?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that was one of the reasons. But if you look at the period of time where state hospital population really started dropping, it was really before there were some of, I mean, Thorazine had come on board then, and I'm sure that, you know, everybody thinks that was one of the major factors. But other factors, particularly in the early 60s, were the development of the Social Security disability insurance system, which allowed people to have income so that they didn't have to stay in the state hospital because they were basically destitute and there was no place else for them to go. So there were some other things. I think the whole civil rights movement and the rethinking about whether people should be locked up for long periods of time had something to do with this. And frankly, state hospitals had become kind of a catch-all institution for people who had no place else to go. So a lot of older people who had no real mental health problems but had nowhere else to go were in there. People with alcohol and drug problems ended up in state hospitals. And people who were just odd ended up in state hospitals, in addition to the major mental illnesses. So I think the state hospitals became a kind of a catch-all institution beginning in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And so there were probably a lot of reasons other than medication that allowed us to begin moving people out. But medications was certainly one of those.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the community mental health movement, as it was known, took a public health and psychotherapy direction. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in my opinion, looking back on this, unless you really focus on the needs of kids with severe emotional disorders and adults with serious and persistent mental illnesses, if you don't tailor approach to those people and dedicate part of your programming to serve those people who have a multitude of issues to deal with, just offering psychotherapy probably isn't going to be very effective. And I think in the early days of the community mental health system, that was the major learning. And Gina, you might want to comment on that.
Chair Dalto, committee members, the only thing that I would add to that is we've come a long way with medications and types of psychotherapy, and we'll talk more about evidence-based practices later on.
Okay. Just again, fast framing forward, the 80s and 90s were really the beginning of what we think of now as community support projects. The National Institute of Mental Health had a program that really got moving in this direction. Oregon, and I think even in the late 70s, had one of the first community support projects. It was down in the Coos Bay area. People have long ago forgotten about that. But it was one of the innovative approaches that began to reach out to people with major mental illnesses who would otherwise be in state hospitals or on the streets and really serve them in the kind of way that we now know is it turns out to be the most cost-effective evidence-based approaches. We began in the early 80s to have a much clearer idea of the degree to which alcohol and drugs were part of the mix that we were dealing with. We had one of the 13 National Institute of Mental Health projects in Oregon in the late 80s. I was actually the director of that program here in Marion County. And we served young adults 18 to 45, I think was the age group at the time. That age group keeps creeping up as we all age in place here. But we served the people who no one else wanted to serve in that project, and we demonstrated that people with major mental illnesses and alcohol and drug problems will respond to treatment, but you have to go to where they are, not be passive. You have to tailor your approach. You don't ping pong them back and forth between the alcohol and drug system and the mental health system. You don't, for example, tell them, we'll give you alcohol and drug treatment when all of your symptoms are stabilized. You don't tell them, we'll treat you for your mental health problem when you stop drinking. You really have to provide simultaneous treatment. And Oregon was, again, one of the leaders in the country in trying to grapple with how we best serve people with the co-occurring disorders. We've seen a rising cost of affordable housing in the state. Portland is one of the most expensive places in the country to live now. And if you want to look very far for explanations for some of the problems in the Portland area with homelessness and mentally ill, I don't think you have to look too far to realize that the cost of housing there is an issue. I also want to say this is an issue not in just urban areas, but also in suburban and rural areas as well. Developments from 1990 to the present that I just wanted to highlight, and these are, you know, not an exclusive list, but I think our training programs in our universities and community colleges are still trying to catch up. We're working with them on that issue through my office, and I'm optimistic that in the next couple of years we're going to do a little bit better job. But we've not implemented consistently everything that we know in the research literature from the last 20 to 30 years. And while this may not be, you know, the purest of science, I do think we know much more now than we did 20 years ago. We don't need to operate off hunches or old technology, and I think that we can and will be implementing more in the way of what we call evidence-based practices. The property tax limitation measures that passed in the early 90s really forced this state, as well as most other states, to turn more and more to federal sources of funds, particularly Medicaid. And if you look at the budget, you'll see that we are highly dependent on federal Medicaid dollars. We have very little general fund, relatively speaking, compared to the federal dollars that are now in the system. That's both good and bad. I mean, the good part of it is we get, for the most part, a very nice match. For 40 cents of state dollars, we get another 60 cents of federal money. So a lot of the community programs, which we know are just as effective and more effective than institutional care, are actually, in this case, the most cost-effective as well. We've developed many model programs. I mentioned a couple of them and approaches. I think the Oregon Health Plan has been a model for the country in terms of treating major mental illnesses just like other physical health care problems. I probably should just take a moment to say there's debate, of course, about everything in mental health, but I think it's fairly clear that there's a biological component to mental illnesses, and it's not how you're toilet trained, frankly, that leads you to at some point be diagnosed with schizophrenia. It's much more complex than that. There's no doubt that family dynamics and social environments do affect how people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder function in a community, but it looks to me, as I look at the literature, that there is truly a biological base. It may or may not be genetic. There are a lot of theories yet about whether it's, you know, there's an whether it was a viral infection in mom, and there are, you know, a lot of different debates on this, and I'm not prepared to go into great detail with you on it, other than just to point out that I think we need to recognize that we're dealing with things that are in part physical disorders, just like the flu or diabetes or chronic heart conditions, etc. And I think the Oregon Health Plan was a step in the right direction in terms of recognizing that.
Again, Boone.
Do you also think then, or believe the premise that early childhood sexual abuse has a big part in some mental disorders, particularly personality disorders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I think that's certainly an area of emerging awareness on the part of all of us. There are studies that indicate that as many as 95% of people with major mental illnesses have experienced some kind of traumatic event in their life, either before or after their illness developed. And I think it's clear that severe trauma does create certain kinds of psychiatric disorders. I don't think there's evidence that it creates things like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, but it really complicates and makes a much greater challenge treating people who have had severe trauma, and if they happen to also have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, and then you add in alcohol and drugs into the mix, which are often there, you have a very complicated set of issues. I think we know more and more about how to deal with this, so I don't think we're hopeless and standing around helpless about this issue, but we are recognizing more and more that trauma is a piece of what we need to be aware of and dealing with.
Mr. Chair, this is a little bit disconnected back to your just the previous slide about the housing and cost of housing. Is there any? I've been trying to research this on my own too, but is there any program whereby people can donate a used mobile home or manufactured home that would? So whatever the program would be, or somehow provide funding for rehab if that's necessary, to provide more affordable housing for homeless people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I haven't heard that idea. That's very interesting. We've had some work with Habitat for Humanity, which is kind of beginning to shade into the direction you're talking about. Oregon has had one of the most effective housing development programs, largely because of one particular staff person who's been in my office for, well, longer than I have, which is 15 years. Her name is Vicki Scria, and I always like to mention her name because there are reasons to be concerned about bureaucrats, but Ms. Scria is not one of those. She's helped create now property value, I understand now, is over $75 million worth of housing in the last 12 years for people with major mental illnesses in this state. She uses a small amount of state general fund that's in our budget, and she works with Bob Repine's department to create and with federal dollars. So for every dollar we have in our mental health budget, we're able to match that with 14 or 15 other dollars of other kind of housing loans. So because of that, we've been able to leverage and create a lot of federally subsidized housing, in some cases state-funded loans that help us with this. Ms. Scria is so creative that I will mention the idea to her, and she will probably be very interested in learning more about how to do this, because that's what she's all about, frankly.
Thank you. And let me know what happens.
I will. That $75 million worth of housing includes some residential and group home kinds of things, but for the most part, it's independent housing. As you can see, most people live in and prefer, frankly, to live in independent housing. So most of that is independent housing stock, and I think we've created something like over 1,000 individual units with that. Quickly, again, not an exhaustive list, but these are some of the issues that I think we're really challenged with. There are more mentally ill people in jails and prison, despite, actually in this state, a dramatic increase in the last 8 to 10 years in access to acute psychiatric hospital care. When we closed Damish, we were admitting maybe a little over 1,000 people each year to what we call acute psychiatric care. When we closed Damish and in the years before that, we began developing community hospitals which have psychiatric units, and there are probably 15 of them around the state, mostly on the west side of the mountains. So the number of acute psychiatric admissions has gone from about 2,000 8 years ago to about 6,000 acute care psychiatric admissions per year. So in spite of dramatically increasing access to acute psychiatric care, we still are having too many people with mental illnesses in our jails. So these are issues that we need to continue to try to probe and understand so that we know, why that is that happening.
Representative Jensen.
Could you get me a copy of a list of those hospitals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen will be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Another issue that I touched on briefly was the need to implement more evidence-based practices. Senate Bill 267 certainly has pushed us, I think, nicely in that direction. Dr. Furman may want to comment on some of the concerns that are out there about that. Although I think there's general agreement that this is the direction to be going, but want to...
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, evidence-based practices, Senate Bill 267, we're actually very delighted in the concept because that is the area in which we are heading and should be heading. The concern is that as we go through old things that we've been doing and new things that we've been doing and trying them out, there is a cost for new technology and to make sure that everybody is trained and up to speed. We are moving in that direction. I think that some of the rumblings that you may have heard about how can we afford evidence-based practices, because some of them are very expensive. I think where we're at in the field right now is that people are stepping up to the plate. We did, with the state last September, did a survey of where we thought people were, and it gave us a good baseline. But what we figured out is some people think they're doing 100% evidence-based practices, and others think that they're not doing what they should. So we're working on getting it formatted for you so we can get a really good read. The counties that I've visited and programs that I've looked at, I think we have a good mix. A program that you may be familiar with, assertive community treatment, only serves about 15% of the population, and it's very, very expensive. But where we do have it instituted, it's working very, very well. That's just one evidence-based practice. One of the other things that I would want to mention to you is, as Mr. Nickel went through the list of things that we do have in the communities and need more of, last session, supported employment was cut out of the mix, and that's an evidence-based practice that the legislature can do something about. So as we take a look at any one of you or anybody, not just somebody that's mentally ill, need to have a good job, need to have a roof over your head, and feel good about your life. And so those are all things that your community mental health system is piecing together along with medications and treatment and making sure that they're in the right facility or right treatment setting. The other thing that I wanted to add is Mr. Nickel and I had an opportunity to view a new crisis resolution center in Bend, and there's one in Southern Oregon too. We believe that this may be the wave of the future and may not save us any money right now today, but in the long run can save us a significant amount of dollars. And these are community placements of 16 or less because of Medicaid rules that people can go to in their community. Families are available to visit them there, and it's a stopping ground, so they won't go to the state hospital. And they've had relative success in other areas, and we're looking forward to that in Bend. So that definitely will emerge.
Thank you. Gina, a couple of things. What do we need to offer in the community to keep people out of jails? And do you have a comparison of how much it costs to keep people in jails as opposed to, what was it, assertive something?
Assertive community
treatment. Mm-hmm. You said that was expensive. So I don't know if you've got these figures today, but if you could give us figures on how, comparing how much it would cost to put someone in that program as opposed to putting them in a community.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we don't have those figures with us today, but we certainly can get those for you.
Great. And what especially makes, if I may have a
follow up,
what makes that treatment expensive?
Do you want to answer that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, what makes it expensive is that it's very staff intensive. In other words, the caseloads are, you know, to do what they call high fidelity replication of this model, you have to have a caseload of one staff person for every 10 clients. Right now, the average caseload around the state for serving people with major mental illness is probably 40 or 50. So you can see that compared to what the average caseload size is, you'd have to have much smaller caseloads. You also work as a team, so you have a doctor, a nurse, usually a vocational specialist that's attached to the team, as well as a case manager. And then often now the model includes peer support, so that you have people who are recovering from mental illness themselves, who really know what it's like and can really teach the real skills that people need to survive out there. So you have a very intensive staff mix. So it's not bricks and mortar that costs. It's really the staffing costs.
Really like to visit one of these places, if there are any close by, either in Portland or Salem or close by. That would be great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Anderson.
I'll pass.
Representative Greenlink.
You slipped quickly by the notion that 16 beds or less qualifies for Medicaid. I know there's a lot of your work trying to create movement out of facilities that don't qualify for Medicaid and ones that do. Would you just talk a little bit about that 16-bed issue and where we're going with it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, if you'll forgive me, just a quick departure to 1852. President Franklin Pierce vetoed a bill that had passed both houses of the federal Congress that would have made the federal government responsible for developing land-grant funding for state hospitals. Mm-hmm. That set the stage for the federal abdication of responsibility, and maybe that was the right policy decision, but it dates back to 1852, where the federal government will not get involved, for the most part, in funding state hospitals. So that led over time, now I'm jumping ahead many years, to a federal Medicaid regulation that says that the federal government will not fund anything that they consider to be, and this is a quote, an institution for mental disease. So that's the IMD rule, as we call it in shorthand, which basically, I mean, it's a complicated thing, but basically it says the federal government won't allow Medicaid funding for anything that's larger than 16 beds. You know, that was kind of the arbitrary number they came up with. So when Dr. Furman referred to 16-bed facilities, you look at the list and the size of the facilities we fund out in the community, we fund absolutely no institutions for mental diseases with Medicaid money in the community. All of the downsizing projects we've done are 16 or smaller.
So it's a virtual state hospital that Pierce hadn't thought about as a Pierce.
Yes, that's correct. Well, let me just finish this particular slide, Mr. Chair, and I'll then think we might want to move into talking about a couple of other things. We need to balance the needs that we have with budget realities, and that's the big challenge that I think we all face in this session. I don't think anybody believes that we have too much money in the mental health system. Maybe there are a few people. The conclusion, again, of the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, the very first systemic problem that was identified was that the system is underfunded. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't do everything that we possibly can to make a system work with whatever funding we have to do that we have to work with. But I do think we have to find ways to balance the needs that we recognize with budget realities. Another balancing act is the need for public safety and civil rights. There are many people who consider themselves consumers, survivors, ex-patients, who would really like for us to do completely away with any kind of involuntary treatment. And as a conceptual goal, I actually agree with that. The realities of it are that we don't always know how to get to people soon enough and to work with them on a voluntary basis. I do think that one of the challenges for the system is to make mental health services so good and so attractive that people don't want to run away from them. So that's part of the challenge that we have. We need to continue to achieve more cost-effective methods, particularly for long-term care. The state hospital is a very expensive level of care. In terms of state general fund dollars, it's the most expensive level of care.
At some point, could we have a chart again? And you may not have it today, so it's not important today, but that chart of how the state hospital fits in on the spectrum of cost for different mental health care treatment settings. I've seen it a bunch of times. It's a great chart, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll go back and find that and get that to the committee. I think we need to begin responding better to changing Oregon demographics, particularly the large number of Hispanic people who are coming to Oregon. We need more bilingual and bicultural capability in our programs, and there's always some lag time on that. We need to, frankly, go out and recruit Hispanic young people who are in high school and community colleges and convince them that a career in mental health and addictions would be a good choice for them, and then we need to pay them properly so that we can compete with the other businesses that are out there looking for the same very capable young people. And I think a continued challenge is always improving state, county, and regional coordination. Dr. Furman and I have made it a commitment to the system to not fight with each other. The state and the counties really do need to work in partnership, which is exactly what the state law tells us to do. ORS 430 is very clear on that the state is to partner with counties to deliver a community mental health system. And I think that we have done a successful job of that, and Dr. Furman might want to comment. Or not.
On whether I fight with you or not. Chair Dalto, committee members, what I'd like to do right now is to show you this buff-colored paper that you have in front of you, just to go over so you can see the lay of the land of what is. On Friday, you will have individuals come in and talk to you about community services, the adult program, the children's program, civil commitment, and pieces of that program. But just for your purview, so you can see about how many clients we have in the non-Medicaid system. By county, because I know all of you like to sometimes look at each individual counties and where you are and how many people they serve. Adult community outpatient, you can see the estimated number of clients. And the reason that they're estimated, because we're not at the end of the biennium yet, so you can see about how many clients are being served with general fund monies. And then, of course, with the governor's recommended budget right next to that column, that's approximately about how many people would be cut from that service. So you could just see across adult crisis services, older and disabled adults, and then other community mental health treatments. That's usually the dollars that goes out to the communities, into community hospitals, psychiatric inpatient, et cetera. That, at this point, in the governor's recommended budget, is not proposed to be cut, but I wanted you to see how many clients are in the general fund system and what the lay of the land is today before you have your conversations about the mental health system.
President Greenlake.
Thank you, sir. Can you help me with these definitions? I'm intrigued. I mean, I immediately looked to Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah County to see what's going on, because they were under some pressure from this committee in the interim to try and integrate services. We'll talk about that yet. And it looks like a relatively logical proportion under adult community outpatient, but the crisis services looked very out of balance, and it looks like what one county is calling crisis service may be the other two counties calling other community mental health. What is the difference between those columns?
I think what you'll find, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, is in Washington County. Washington County contracts out for most of their services, so that's where you're going to see the differences in the numbers.
And Clackamas as well?
And Clackamas does most of theirs in-house, but they do count a little bit different. And a lot of the crisis calls are in Multnomah County, because of the facilities that they have.
May I follow, Mr. Chair?
Oh.
I mean, Multnomah has 5,500 and Clackamas 200 and Washington 300 of the crisis, but when you go over to other services, you find that they're much closer. Clackamas has 3,500 and Washington 4,500 in the other.
And again, it's
handling the problem differently.
It is the way that they handle the problem and then therefore count it.
Might be interesting to hear how they do from the counties.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, we actually have a person from Clackamas County coming to talk to you on Friday, and I can discuss that with her, and we'll address that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to flip ahead here. This is something that we alluded to earlier. This is a pie chart that just shows you roughly for 03, 05 the percentage of budget in the state hospital, which is on the right-hand side, 25%. And again, these are total funds. The community mental health system at that point was $192 million. Administrative support that goes to the counties and to the counties is less than 2% of the total funds. And I believe that, and then the Oregon Health Plan, as you can see, is the bulk now of the community mental health system. So when we talk about the Oregon Health Plan being central to community mental health, that's a very graphic representation of that. And then I believe I put in, well, let me just throw this up, not because I intend to go through this in any detail. When we contract out to the counties, there are these what we call service elements, 20, 21, 22, down there in the left-hand column. Each one of those is a specific type of service that we contract for certain kinds of things to happen in the community mental health system. So some of these are the categories that Dr. Furman has shown you on the yellow piece of paper. There's adult outpatient. There's children's outpatient. There's crisis. there's supported employment. There are also some monies in there for indigent acute care, which we try to contract through the counties as much as possible for them to buy beds in their local hospitals if they can do that for people who are not Medicaid eligible but who have psychiatric hospitalizations. So I just wanted to show you this as a kind of a quick and dirty look at a little bit more detail of what's in the contracts with the counties. This shows the with colors and pie slices, kind of how that's all divided up. I could get copies of this to you if you want to look at it, although I think it'd be, we're working on the same kind of information for the 05-07 Ways Means presentation, but this is last year's document. This I want to show you because this is in one page a representation of how the mental health system is put together. And let me just, I'm not going to, again, go through it in great detail, but generally at the top you have outpatient kinds of things that are relatively less costly per patient per day, and you go all the way down to the next to the bottom layer is state hospitals, which are the most expensive. At the very bottom I put the Federal PATH homelessness projects, which is a fairly small amount of money and not serving that many people. But ultimately, if we're unsuccessful, in my opinion, in serving people throughout the rest of the public mental health system, they will become homeless or they will end up in prisons and jails. So the Oregon Health Plan plus population represents a pretty big chunk, as you can see, in the top layer of outpatient care. Some of the money there actually goes to the acute care hospitals, which is shown in the polka dot pattern there in acute care hospitals in about the fourth layer down. We have employment supports, as Dr. Furman mentioned, which was something that got cut. We have some crisis respite programs. An example of that was the Sageview project that Dr. Furman and I visited last week in Bend. It actually is a beautiful example of where we need to be going, in my opinion, too. I couldn't agree more. We have regular residential or group homes. We have extended care and enhanced care projects, which really take people out of the state hospital. And we have children's intensive treatment services in about 601 beds or slots. That includes psychiatric day treatment and psychiatric residential care for kids. And finally, state hospitals. So this is, I believe I included this in the packet, and I'd be happy to answer questions at some point if you have them. But I've been told that in if there's one picture that shows the whole mental health system in a way that, you know, you can almost make sense of, this is the slide. So I wanted to share it with you. I hope it works as intended. I want to show you quickly changing access to mental health and substance abuse from about 10 years ago. As you can see, we've been moving up for both kids and adults. The dramatic increase for serving children really took place about 10, 15 years ago when the state was faced with a lawsuit, and we began to get much more Medicaid money into the children's mental health system. It increased about tenfold about 10, 15 years ago. So what you're seeing there is really the top of something that had actually seen a dramatic increase. And as you can see, from 2002-2003, we began to decline. That's largely a result of the loss of the Oregon Health Plan standard benefit package. So I wanted to just show you a quick slide on that, and I think that's the end of the slideshow.
Okay. Reverend Jensen, thank you. You talked a little about this community mental health state partnership. I think, as you're aware, I'm from Multnomah County. And I know you're aware of the situation with the community program there. I'm very concerned about this this whole issue of how oversight takes place, where responsibility is, what statute calls for. Just quite candidly, I think we are terribly fortunate that we didn't have some disastrous consequence of the program, or as a consequence of the program, at least as it's reported,
coming out of that that might have caused us to be looking at, you know, in economic terms, a major lawsuit or lawsuits, and in human terms, even perhaps more costly than what the dollars might have been. And you know, I'd like to have somewhere, and I don't, it doesn't have to be today or whenever, but I'd like to have somewhere, Mr. Chair, a presentation or a discussion about this chain of commands, if that's the right way or right words, the oversight, if that's the right words, or the fiscal responsibility, if that's the right word, the flow of this thing, because this is not a situation. First of all, the situation is not yet resolved, and secondly, it's a situation that I personally would not want to see reappear either in Umatilla County or in any other county or any other program in the state of Oregon. So I'd just like to have somewhere in your discussions, you know, where we're at, what we're doing, what we've been doing, and what, if there's any plan to change, and how that plan, and is there any legislation that's necessary to deal with this issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the statute that's relevant here is in ORS 430, and in addition to the requirement that we partner, there's also language that authorizes us to regulate, and we can get some of that material to the committee if you'd like to look at that. So there are limitations on how well Dr. Kerman and I get along. There are times when I have to perform the regulatory function that's also statutorily required of us, and that's indeed what we had to exercise in Umatilla County. I can tell you Dr. Furman and I both worked very closely on that issue, and while she had a different role to play than I had to play, we did try to work this out in as collaborative way as possible. We ended up having the county give the program back to us. They felt that they could not meet the requirements that we had, and so as you mentioned, we're in a transition period now. We think we are very close to having a contract that will be signed by another organization that will come in and operate the program for Umatilla County. And I really think that everybody is going to, in the end, feel satisfied that we all did the right thing collectively.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. I certainly wouldn't quarrel that maybe we'll get to the point we want to be. I probably always will quarrel a little bit with whether we acted as promptly as we maybe should have on this issue.
If we could follow up with some correspondence to the committee on that issue. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if you would permit, I think at this point I'd like to shift gears and talk a little bit about the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, because I'm certain that one of the things that this committee will be interested in hearing about, from not just from people like myself or Dr. Furman, but how do people see the system functioning. That was really one of the key issues that the Governor asked us to deal with in the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. The charge to the work group was to identify systemic problems. If you look at the task force report, and I believe we got copies of this distributed a couple of months ago, but I don't know if recently you've had a chance to look at it. I'd be happy to get additional copies if the committee would like those. But I wanted to walk through in fairly rapid fashion the 10 systemic problems, because I think one of the worst things we can do is either say there are no problems or the whole system's broken. I think there are clearly some issues. I think the task force did a good job of identifying those, and I'd just like to walk through those now so that they're on the record. The first of those I've already mentioned. The system is significantly underfunded.
Before you get started in this, I want to hear the whole presentation, but we need to take a break for about 5 minutes, so we'll stand in recess. Interruption, but I did not want to miss a moment of this testimony, so thanks for that. I guess that's what I get to do when I have the gavel. So that's one of the advantages. Okay, sorry about that.
Mr. Chair, Chair, your timing is very good. Actually, we had copies of just the systemic problem section run off, so now I have my notes to refer to again.
Great.
Thank you for the short break. First, so I've mentioned the system is significantly underfunded, and I won't go through all the detail, but some of the cuts that we had last session, which aren't obvious mental health cuts, have made some of these issues more difficult to deal with. For example, the medically needy program allowed a lot of people access to medications. I think of the 8,000 people approximately who were on the medically needy program, about 4,000 of them were people who had psychiatric problems and were getting psychiatric medicine. So a cut in medically needy had a fairly direct but maybe not an obvious effect on the ability of the system to stay afloat. The second systemic problem really had to do with trying to clarify how the Oregon Health Plan managed care organizations that deal with the mental health benefit, how they interface with the county mental health system. Now, in reality, many of the counties operate their own mental health organization and have responsibility for the Medicaid dollars, but in some counties, it's not quite as clear how that works, and so there was a desire on the part of the task force members to have us further clarify some of those roles and responsibilities. The third systemic problem was the state's administration of funding of mental health services is not well coordinated or commonly managed. And the concept here is not so much that I don't have a coordinated system, although some people might argue that. The fact is that there are actually more mental health services delivered outside the control that my office has than I have control over. The Department of Education, for example, actually offers quite a few mental health services. The Department of Corrections offers quite a few mental health services. Other state and local government entities do provide mental health services. Local jails often have access to or create access to psychiatric care. Often the counties with some funding that we have provide that, but sometimes the counties offer up their own funding for that. The cost of medications, for example, in jails is not something that my office has any responsibility or, frankly, the resources to provide. So jails often are paying a large amount each year for psychotropic medication. So those are examples of many other entities, both local and state, that have some responsibility or some interest in providing mental health services. And the sense of the task force was that that's not really that well coordinated, and I would agree with that. I think that's a challenge for us. Number four, we've already talked about too many persons with mental illness are in prisons and jails. I think one of the things that really jumps out when you hear Oregon Youth Authority officials talk is that 60% of the kids that they have in their facilities have a severe or at least some kind of psychiatric or emotional problem. That's, you know, 60% is a huge number. Number five, we've already touched on to some degree, there are too few community resources, particularly housing. One of the things that jumps out in this particular section is that we estimate that Oregon needs at least 14,713 additional safe and affordable housing units compared to what we have. So although we've created 1,000, we're still 14,000 short. Number six, is a finding that basically says that we haven't planned or invested in or maintained adequate community resources, and as a result, we have gridlock. Now, the best example, there are two good examples of that. One is that this morning we're 64 patients over our funded capacity in the forensic units of the state hospital. We also have a waiting list at any given time of 20 to 30 people who are waiting to get into the civil commitments of the state hospital and who are waiting in these, you know, 10 to 15, depending on any given time, community psychiatric units. So the patients have been there. They've been treated as much as we can, but we're not going to be able to release them in the usual average of 10 to 12 days. They need to go to the state hospital or something like the state hospital, and because we're overcrowded there, we can't get them in. The reason we're able to control census on the civil commitment units is that we don't have state or federal court decisions that require us to admit those patients within a certain period of time, whereas we do have that on the forensic side. So we have an indirect problem in the wait list problem for the state hospital for civilly committed patients. These are people who are not committed to crime but are involuntarily committed to our care. But we do have requirements from the federal and state courts that we admit criminally committed people. So people who are either needing to be treated until they're able to stand trial, or people who have been adjudicated as guilty except for insanity. Those are the two criminal populations that we deal with, or I should say criminally committed populations we deal with in the state hospital forensic units. So this is number six, really was speaking to that whole set of very complicated issues that we're working on.
A question from staff.
Bob, just for the purpose of this, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the purpose of this report, how are you defining housing units? Are those individual units, or are they a combination of individual families?
Mr. Chair, it would be primarily individual housing units.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The seventh systemic problem that was identified was that the emphasis on acute care and incarceration, in other words, taking care of the immediate crises, has led us to not emphasize enough early intervention and prevention. I think that's a tragedy because I'm convinced that we did earlier, albeit more expensive, early intervention services to people who are having their first psychotic episodes, or we treated young kids more effectively earlier, or if we had a better way to prevent mental health problems to begin with, and we do know something about this, if we could invest more in that, we wouldn't be dealing with some of the end-term problems that continue to capture so much of our time and, frankly, so much of our resources. But the issue is here, how do you get ahead of that curve? Because it does require some additional front-end investment. And it's, you know, that's a difficult thing for us to pull off. Problem number eight has to do with parity of mental health insurance. Number nine.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Before you skip over on that, could you talk a little bit about that and what you might propose that the legislature attempt this year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, several bills, as you know, have already been introduced this session, and so the governor's office convened a meeting earlier this week to begin to get the key stakeholders who are interested in this issue together to see if there's anything we can do this session that would get us to a mental health and chemical dependency parity approach that would actually pass. So that's on the table for consideration. The governor's mental health task force, the very first of the recommendations had to do with encouraging the legislature to work on that issue and to pass a parity bill this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Number nine, the mental health system, like most other parts of healthcare, does not take advantage of modern information systems. And again, I think everybody recognizes that we're often dealing with outdated information technology systems. Obviously, again, I think the front-end investment makes it difficult to do that. I think most community mental health systems are much more connected to information systems electronically than they were. The Oregon Health Plan, again, I think was a major boost in that area, and Dr. Sherman may want to comment on that part of it.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as far as the information systems go, we've still got a long ways to go. Each county has their own information system. Sometimes it interfaces well with the state, sometimes it does not. However, with the HIPAA laws that have come down, it has provided us an opportunity to work with the state directly, and we've been working with a number of people at the state as well as Cindy Becker to make sure that we collect adequate data. And we are, I think, pretty well there. We still have a little ways to go, but I do want to tell you sometimes it's very, very hard to get the data collected that we need.
Mr. Chair, the tenth and last of the systemic problems was that there's not a sufficient statewide effort to integrate mental health care with addiction services and other physical health care. I think the state's combining of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services a couple of years ago was a step in that direction, but I think we also have to understand that rearranging boxes doesn't necessarily accomplish that, and there's a great deal of hard work that is yet to be done in not only integrating mental health and addiction services, and I think we're making some good headway on that, but also the even more challenging issue of better integrating mental health care with physical health medicine. So we have initiatives that are involved in that, and there are a couple of recommendations later in the task force report that speak to that.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to address that one. As we talk about mental health services and what is the mental health services that the state and the county should be providing, I cannot emphasize enough about what has happened in the addictions treatment field. The cuts that have been sustained over the last biennium, and I know this isn't Ways and Means, but I just want, as you hear the mental health system, please really keep in mind that the addiction treatment system goes hand in hand with mental health integrated, and the funds that have been cut off that particular part of the program, I believe, I'll speak for myself, are really a problem in the state of Oregon and in communities. And you'll find that communities that do addiction treatment, they're really struggling because there's just simply not enough money in that particular part of the system. And we can talk about how the whole system is underfunded, but we have to live within our budget. But I want to tell you that's particularly the part of the system, addictions treatment, that is right there, very tenuous.
Mr. Chair, if I could, what I'd like to do is just point out a couple of things in the report, and we're bringing copies over from my office now. Maybe they've arrived. Okay, great. I would call particular attention to the, on page 11, there's a list of values and principles, and, you know, I think sometimes it's easy to get a little weary of values and principles, but I do think it's worth taking a little bit of time. I won't do that now, but to look over those things. One of the things that I've been pushing really hard in the time that I have allotted to me as the administrator in this office is, really are three things. One is the whole idea of recovery, that we need a recovery-oriented approach to everything that we do, whether it's addictions or mental health. And we have to understand that people really do, for the most part, have the capability of getting back to a fairly normal life. Some people get completely back to where they'd hope to be. Other people do get pretty close. And I think that whole recovery concept is something that we need to keep in mind. Cultural competency, I think, is another key issue for my office and for the system to keep working toward, and finally the implementation of evidence-based practices over time. So the values and principles, I think, are really quite consistent with those kind of approaches. Then there are a series of findings in the report. I'm not going to go through all those. There are 24 of them. And then there are a series of 12 categories of recommendations, and I think a total of 50 or 51 specific action items that the task force asked us to begin working on. What I've done in my office is I've assigned a staff person to every one of the recommendations. That doesn't mean that my office is actually able to accomplish all of these, because many of them are systemic kinds of issues that need to be dealt with. But I felt that our office was the most obvious and visible place, and we ought to take responsibility for at least tracking every one of these things. And on those that we can do something about, we're going to do something about them. But I made a commitment to the task force, and I was a member of it myself, but I made a commitment that we were not going to just let the reports sit on the shelf. We were going to make a best effort to implement every one of these that we can. On our webpage, if you're interested, you can see the action plan that we've put up there and exactly which staff have been assigned to which particular recommendation. The one thing I do want to call attention to is the, in addition to the parity recommendation, which was clearly one of the number one concerns that the group had, there are issues related to the criminal justice system, and the single largest area of recommendations is Section C. It begins on page 21, and there are 11 different recommendations. I've assigned one staff person full-time to do nothing but work on those issues. And again, some of these things are clearly things that are the responsibility of other levels of government or the Department of Corrections, but we really need to be about trying to figure out how our office and the state mental health system can be a key player in accomplishing these particular recommendations. The very last recommendation calls for the Oregon Health Commission, or Health Policy Commission, to be the holder of the document and hold my feet to the fire. And so we've had our first meeting with them, I believe, last week to begin briefing them on the findings of the task force and also on the action items. So.
Mr. Chair, two other additions that I want to talk about in the Governor's Mental Health Task Force that we talked about that came up last session is equity. That's number one. And also regionalization. And I just wanted to address those right off if you had questions about that. For a number of years, there has been the attitude that payments have come from the state to the counties inequitable, meaning that counties get paid differently. And we have been talking about that for years and trying to come up with a strategy, and it's been very difficult. But I do want to give Mr. Nickel credit. Over the last year, a group of counties have sat down, and we've come up with, we're not there completely yet, but we do have a strategy that will begin to equalize payments and treat counties more equitably. And so we are on the road there. Some of examples have been, for instance, Deschutes County in the last 10 years have had an explosive population, and so the monies being given to Deschutes County hasn't kept up with the population. That's just an example. There's a lot of examples, and once you overlay those over years, then the money seems to be going askew. But I want to assure you that counties are in agreement, and we are on the right track of getting the formula back to more equitable standards, and that's due to Mr. Nichols' leadership on that. Regionalization, that was quite a conversation last session. Is, you know, why don't we have more regions? Why can things be done more effectively? And I want to assure you that's one of the reasons why mental health organizations were formed as regions. They have to have somebody to contract back to in communities and counties, and that's done. I also wanted to point out that a good regions can't be forced, if you will. Sometimes people don't like to work together, and it's hard to force them. But counties naturally come together in regions to talk about their problems. And a good example is we talked about the Crisis Resolution Center just being built in Deschutes County. That was really an effort by Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook County to come together and realize what they needed in their region and come up with a solution and build it. So I think if we continue to encourage that, and that's exactly what the report calls for, is encouraging our regionalization projects, and we're seeing that happen more and more.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it might be good to shift gears once more and talk a little bit about the Oregon State Hospital and update the committee so that you know where we're at. I mentioned already that we're 64 patients over our funded capacity this morning. In order to discharge people from the forensics unit, and I'm going to speak primarily of people who are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, which board has existed since, I think, 1977, and it's there for the supervision and monitoring and protection of public safety for any person in the state who is found guilty except for insanity. So it's the insanity plea in Oregon. Oregon has one of the tightest systems of supervision for people who plead guilty except for insanity of any state in the country. In order to discharge a person, there has to be a resource to discharge them to, so there has to be an adequate resource funding-wise and a program that matches that patient's need. The PSRB, first and foremost, has to approve the release. The state hospital has to feel that the person is ready for discharge, or they won't even get to the PSRB hearing. And finally, the county mental health programs have got to feel comfortable taking the person back into their community, or in some cases, taking people from other communities, because there are times when a person commits a high-profile crime, they probably don't want to, nor should they go back to the community in which the situation occurred. So counties are willing to take people from other communities, but they have to feel comfortable with the risk and the services and the stability of the funding, frankly, that will be there. So you really have four entities that have to agree: the PSRB, the state hospital, the county mental health programs, and my office, which is the funder for these programs. Now, that's a daunting task at times. We've created a record number of new community placements for people leaving the state hospital. But the problem this last year is that we set a record for the number of people who are entering the PSRB system. Let me just walk you through the data real quickly. This year, or actually 2004, there were 126 people who pled guilty except for insanity, and the court ruled that they indeed were. 126. Last year, that number was 110 for 2003. The year before that, I believe it was around 78. And the years before that had bounced around between the 60s and 70s. So what you can obviously see is a dramatic increase in the number of people who are doing this. We don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, when you see several thousand people with mental illnesses in the criminal justice system itself, you have to think, and that number, everybody agrees, has been growing, you would expect that there would be some increase in the number of people who would successfully plead guilty except for insanity. And that may be very good to send them to us rather than to the criminal justice system. That aside, our projections in the development of the budget last session was that we would not have that kind of explosive growth. At the time that we had to do our budget calculations, we were estimating that there was a net increase of 1.5 forensic patients per month. Now, that always seemed like a very astounding increase to me, 1.5 additional patients that we would have, not new patients, but a net increase of 1.5 every month. Our data now shows that that number has increased in the last year or two to 6.2. And that increased forensic patients. So that, you know, that goes a long ways towards at least explaining the flow problem that we have. So that in spite of a record number of discharges, a record number of new placements, we haven't been able to do it fast enough to keep up with the people who are coming in. So that, in a nutshell, is one of the issues that you're reading about in the paper. The units are, and forensic are, all overcrowded. It's a very difficult situation for patients as well as staff and for management. And we're all doing everything we can to try to figure out how we can deal with this. We're turning over every rock in terms of, can we speed up discharges? Can we speed up treatment? Can we speed up even more the development of community resources? And we're doing all those things. The November E-Board authorized us to create an additional 25 adult foster homes and place 50 additional people, not new people into the community, but take people who are in supervised living situations under the board and put them in non-24-hour care if they're ready for that. The board has to agree to that. So, we can't do this stuff unilaterally. But the point is, we're trying to look at everything we can to try to make this system work as efficiently as possible to get control of the census. We also opened a new unit about 8-9 months ago. It took us longer to get the unit ready because of the dilapidated state of the remaining units in the state hospital. It cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars to get the unit ready to go so that it was safe to put patients there. The next unit that we have to open will cost even more in terms of startup funds, and we never see those monies back again. So we have, the cusp of a real dilemma going here. We're working on it. I think that over time we're going to be able to resolve this. We do have additional community placements that are in development right now, and I think we're going to be able to, by the end of this biennium, get much closer to the funded capacity. But this is a real challenge for everybody who's involved with the situation. We've tried to put this on the record every chance we get. We're not trying to keep this information to ourselves because we think it's a collective responsibility, and we're doing everything we can, but we want people to not be surprised at the kind of numbers that we're dealing with. The November Emergency Board also authorized us to create an Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. And again, we've been putting this on the record. We expedited the process for developing a request for proposal. We had a deadline of Monday of this week for proposals to come in from architectural engineering planning firms, and I'm pleased to tell you that we did get some proposals. We'll be evaluating them in the next week. I hope that we can and make a decision by early next week, negotiate a contract, and get the architectural engineering firm that we select started on this process in mid-February. We owe the legislature a report around May 15th. We'll get a preliminary report on May 2nd from the firm that we choose. So this process is moving along. It will not be a narrow look at the state hospital and what size of facility we need to have. It needs to look at the grounds that we have. We have 144 acres and I forget how many buildings. It will look at all that, but it will also look at what we need to be thinking about in terms of facilities that would support the creation of a new potential new hospital or the renovation of old buildings. And it will begin to get us an estimate of the kind of costs and the timelines that we need to be expecting here. So today I have to tell you I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to have an architectural engineer planning firm that will work with us. I had a chance to look over the proposals last evening, and I'm very encouraged with the quality of the proposals that came in. So I think we're heading down a useful track here, but I wanted to give the committee that much of an update on where we're at.
Are those proposals something that we could take a look at?
Chiodalto, I'll check the procurement requirements here. I know that I'm not allowed at this point to even talk to the other six reviewers who are looking at the proposals about what I think about the proposals. So I will check and see what we can do in terms of getting that out. I would hope that we can, because I think it would be encouraging to the committee to see the kind of proposals that have come in.
Okay.
I would be happy to answer any other questions. There's a ton of information that I could give you and that you probably would like to have, but rather than me try to guess what your interest would be, I think I will stop now and just entertain any questions.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I freely am buying into the values and principles that you have stated in on the sheet. I think the administration's goals and your goals and values are very positive, and I see a positive nature in that mental illness can be cured, well, not cured, but certainly people can be brought back into society quite healthily. One thing I just would like to point out, it's kind of one of my things, and that is high quality services, including medications, are available without regard to ability to pay. And I think something that we need to work toward, not in mental health, but in everything, whether it's traffic fines, whether it's medical help from the Oregon Health Plan, is to encourage people to get back into society by taking part in the society and giving back something. And I think for a person that's mentally ill or fallen out of the flow of our society, we're giving them things and not expecting anything of them, and that's not reality. And I think we need to be thinking, and it's going to take a while, because it costs money to supervise, but we need to be thinking about ways that we can help them to volunteer for city, county, state government, to be doing things, interning. You know, we have interns in our offices, and we expect them to come in and learn something from it, and they do, and they ultimately show up in the legislature. I think if we don't expect people to get services without any recompense, we're doing them a disservice. And I hope that down the line we'll be able to encourage programs that will say, look, the people of Oregon have given you some wonderful things to get you back to a place where you really are healthy. How can you help? What can you give? Community service time, whatever. Not cash, help.
Chiodalto, Representative Anderson, if I could just comment on that. I agree entirely with the concept. A number of years ago when I was running the adult program for Marion County, we had a housing fund that allowed us to help people with rent deposits and so on. But it was a revolving fund. And the concept there, and I think this is this kind of thinking we need to be doing, was that if we help you now, we want you to try to repay what you can. And what we found out was, even though these people didn't have a lot of money, when they got their back payments from Social Security, they would usually come in and repay as much of that loan that we had given them as possible. And so I think at the time we were able to recoup about 50% of the money each year that we put out, which surprised me that we were able to do that. But I think, again, the concept is that people actually feel better about themselves if they know down the road they can contribute something back. If it's in that vein, that's fine. We also have created a consumer council that I meet with. In fact, I'm heading back to meet with them after this. And the idea there is that we have a very open discussion about how they can be helpful to the system and how I can be helpful to them. And so I think this sense of mutuality is something that we need to continue to work at. Excellent. I appreciate your comment.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, I just want to comment on that for Representative Anderson and say that in my area, in just one, a couple of, both in Tillamook and Clatsop County that I know of personally, people who have used services and are asking how they can help either mentor people in the program to help them, you know, go through the maze of services. And also one person in particular who is now on a statewide board because she saw a need. She did some volunteer work, and it was, she doesn't have the money to give, but she has her experience and level. And it's been very helpful because people who have actually had the in-the-trenches experience with the state agencies or whatever are often listened to more carefully by some of the clients, and they have a lot of personal experience, like, this is how you want to do this, or this is available. And I think it is happening in a sense, and we, rather than demanding that it happen and forcing it, encourage it and say, you know, when you get on the other side of this fence, maybe it'd really help a lot of people on this side to make it over with your experience. That would be really great to see you again. So I think it's a great idea.
Representative Jansen, no, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the yellow sheet that you hashed out with all the numbers on it, the governor's recommended budget versus 0305, and the reductions that are there, and just for simplicity, picking the crisis services. There is approximately 500 less slots for the crisis services. How are we going to make the determination, whether it's crisis service or the, you know, any of the other items there? How's the determination going to be made? What are we going to do, a similar sort of thing to the Oregon Health Plan, where we chop off a couple more? In other words, eliminate service for a particular, you know. Do you have to have a gun in your hand when you call a crisis service, you know, a suicide prevention sort of thing? Or if you haven't gone and gotten the gun, you're really not. I'm overstating the illustration, but maybe you could help me with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, you know, those indeed are the kind of questions, hopefully not as dramatically as the gun episode, but already I have to tell you that the crisis services have to do, are already doing some prioritization. So, I mean, without being flip about this, it's like, how depressed are you? And, you know, one of the things that will get you in the door for sure of a crisis program now is if you are suicidal and you have a plan, you're going to be seen. But the clinicians and the people who deal with the front door are going to have to make finer distinctions with these kind of cuts than they currently are doing. So it's going to come down, I'm sure, to some clinical decisions about whether the person, you know, how high a risk is this particular person for something bad happening if we don't serve them.
Yeah, follow up.
Typically, a lot of the crisis services are telephone. Over the phone, the first contact, at least that people have, and I do realize that some of the crisis workers are well trained and very professional. You know, in the few moments over the phone, I'm hard pressed to understand exactly how we're going to say, "Whoops, you don't make it. You're one step below the." Service category.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's why it takes well-trained people. In fact, I would tell you that Mr. Nickel and I, even though we're administrators now, we still get those phone calls from different people's offices, and you have to make a determination, and you better be well-trained.
So it's not as neat as it is on the Oregon. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
No,
it's not as neat as it is on the Oregon Health Plan. We don't have these diagnostic numbers, and you have to reach a certain point on the diagnostic number.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, of course. I mean, that what you have to do is determine whether that person is dangerous to self or others, and there are different degrees in between.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, if I could just tie this back to the discussion about equity, too. That's part of why getting to equity is a very critical exercise that we need to do, because some counties are relatively better funded for crisis services, and in that particular county, maybe they don't have to draw quite as fine a line. Those counties that are below the, below a certain line on crisis services per capita are going to have to make those distinctions, and I think that's a real problematic policy issue to be dealing with. I would also like to point out that it's primarily people who do not have Medicaid funding that this is going to affect, because the Medicaid funding under the Oregon Health Plan really provides a very comprehensive crisis response capability. But it's people who are the working poor or people who have not yet become disabled and are not on Social Security yet. These are the people that will be most affected. And I'll tie it back into the parity issue, too, just real quickly. But to the degree that we don't have health insurance parity, the public system and its crisis system takes care of all of the crises, whether people have insurance or not, if the insurance doesn't cover mental health. So, I mean, this is a good example, I think, of the way in which a lot of these issues are interrelated to each other.
Editorial comment?
By all means.
The tragedy, I think, is the working poor are going to probably then pay more for this in terms of, you know, the emotional consequence of the action. So often the other groups below are pretty knowledgeable about how to get to the system and work through the system. The working poor are going to be proud. And it's going to be more devastating, I fear, editorial comment, to them than it will be to the poor, if that's the terminology we're using, or the wealthy, if you wish.
Mr. Chair, can I add to that, too? But when you're finished, Bob.
I'm sorry.
I couldn't have said it better. I have a constituent right now who falls into that role or that category, and she finally, after 6 months of trying to prove her disability, had a heart situation that if she had received the services, which she couldn't afford, because she couldn't afford, if she was dropped off her Social Security disability, which she was, she wouldn't have had that happen. Now she has the additional problem of the physical effects, and her emotional state says, okay, I'll quit working, I'll go on all the systems. And she's dealing with that. And I just find that very discouraging for me, because here's a person who wants to work, wants to be responsible, wants to pay her own way, and she's being just sidetracked every inch of the way. So not by the state, it was a federal issue, but just, Bob, you're so right. Representative Jensman, sorry.
Well, I appreciate the editorial comments and by both of you, and I appreciate the presentation by the two of you this morning, and look forward to some more information and some responses to some of the questions that the panel brought up, and we will continue on this issue on Friday. And colleagues, we start session on Friday at 8:30, so we'll pick up with our meeting when the session ends. And with that, I think we'll adjourn the meeting. Thanks.
Thank you.